Hello, and welcome to Frenzied and Sustained. In this week's podcast for a post-stupid society, we make the case for dark matter. We finally provide an answer to the ancient question of whether or not ghosts actually exist. In Songs Under the Microscope, we discuss Bruno Mars' song Grenade, involving the medical condition Legophthalmos. We also get to the truth about why Bob Dylan's Lady is not Lay Lady Laying. In A Sauce, My Kingdom for a Sauce, we make a super intense sweet and sour red pepper sauce. Our hat of the week is found all across Southern Asia and is as functional as it is beautiful. In literally the last section, we look into Shakespearean plays that have not aged well. I'm looking at you, Taming of the Shrew. But kicking us off this week, we have our
Brainy Lecture.
Do ghosts exist? Last week, we said that we would provide the definitive answer to the question of whether or not ghosts exist. And the answer is no, of course they don't. Grow up. So on to this week's matter in hand. Dark matter. You may have spotted that I am a little irritated this week. The reason is, I have been the subject of a robbery. In fact, they robbed me of 96% of all that I owned. The thing is, I left school and all the universe could be explained in terms of protons, neutrons and electrons, together with a few exotic particles and some force-carrying bosons. That was it. All sewn up. The entire universe and all the elements could be constructed from these three particles. You could combine them to make a Tesla Model X, Nike Air Max, dolphins, the Miami Dolphins, bridges, planets, stars, and Panama hats. Then the millennials came along and said that my universe is now only 4% protons, neutrons, and electrons, and the other 96% is either dark matter or dark energy. Just as they were letting that sink in, they somehow made it worse by saying that of my remaining 4%, 3.6% was interstellar dust. So now I'm left with just 0.4%. So you can see why I'm miffed. So the kids have lost 96% of the universe. The missing stuff is considered to be 73% dark energy and 23% dark matter. Today we are going to focus on dark matter. So the obvious response is, are you sure? Followed by, what is dark matter? I need to level with you. We don't really have much of an idea what dark matter is. And there are many in the scientific community who do not think that it exists at all. Let me give you an insight into the struggle we are having with the theories that predict the size of the dark matter particle. It ranges in size from 180 billion times smaller than the electron, and on the top end, the size of the Earth. Oh, and if only the dark matter had the common decency to be dark. I think if a dark particle the size of the Earth wafted between me and my keyboard, I may claim it as found and decide where to put my Nobel Prize. It is invisible, and we have never detected it interacting with any of our matter. I have already promised you a podcast on dark energy, but this is not it. Baby steps. Dark energy is a solution to the strange case of the newly expanding universe. How, 7.5 billion years ago, everything in the universe started flying apart at a much faster rate. This force is so strong that all our large-scale structures will cease to grow. The galaxies and clusters of galaxies will manage to stick together due to mutual attraction from gravity. But those have not yet become bound will never find partners. They will simply accelerate away from each other to spend a lonely existence in the great nothingness. So, Ian, I hear you ask, there is some invisible stuff that doesn't react with anything, but you seem mighty confident that it exists. And didn't you already say that dark matter was invented as your beloved Einstein's general relativity needed it to explain the speed of galactic rotation? Thank you, fictitious but attentive listener. Let's try and put the case for dark matter. So, yes, some of the earliest and most compelling evidence we have had for dark matter's existence comes from the ways that our galaxies rotate. Our Sun is in the middle of the Milky Way, 27,000 light-years from the center and some 25,000 light-years to the rim. It is moving around the Milky Way at around 220 kilometers per second, so a galactic year is 230 million Earth-years. Now imagine your cup of coffee. If you put your spoon in the center and give it a good stir, you will see the center moving at the speed of the spoon and the coffee near the edge moving much slower. Then, the millennials lost 96% of the universe, and we noticed that the stars at the edge of our galaxy, and hundreds of others that we measured, are moving way too fast. In fact, they are moving at the same speed as we are. Given the known mass of the galaxies, at that speed the other stars and dust should be flung off. To stay together, there needs to be a stronger force of gravity. The only way we could get the models of general relativity to work was if we added another 23% of mass into all the galaxies, and suddenly, Einstein's reputation was safe. Now, general relativity has been challenged countless times over the decades, and Einstein always comes out on top. So this is to be considered very strong evidence. Another big piece of evidence was when we watched two galaxy clusters collide. We observed the bullet cluster, with normal matter forming a comet shape as it interacts with the normal matter of the cluster it is hitting. The dark matter sails right through and is detected ahead of the cluster. The next evidence comes in the clumping of our 4%. When the universe was young and hot, everything was pretty uniformly distributed. There was about the same amount of stuff everywhere you looked. The theoretical astronomers built models of how a huge amount of dark matter in the early universe would coagulate and clump. The dark matter collapses under gravity, forming dense clouds of stuff we call halos, and that's what it looks like. So the sorts of dots are individual galaxies, or halos around the galaxies, and the big clumps of clumps are those clusters of galaxies or superclusters. The astonishing thing is, if you compared the results of the simulation to the map of the firmaments, you would not be able to tell them apart, and we don't have an explanation for that unless there is dark matter. And before we rest our case for the prosecution, the final piece of evidence comes from the enduring photo of the remnants of the Big Bang, the cosmic microwave background radiation. 300,000 or 400,000 years after the Big Bang, the universe was 5,000 degrees in temperature everywhere. At these temperatures, atoms can no longer keep it together, and they are shaken apart. The electrons and the protons don't stick together anymore. You just have a sea of electrons and protons floating free. When the universe cooled a bit, solid atoms could form, and when they did, they released a flash of energy that we can still see today. And that is the cosmic microwave background. This gives us a tremendous insight into what the universe looked like immediately after the Big Bang, and how it has evolved ever since. The very uneven temperatures in the cosmic microwave background were modeled by varying the amounts of atoms in the universe and adding dark energy and dark matter until we get the best possible fit. And when we do that, we reach this conclusion that about 85% of all the matter in the universe isn't atoms, it's this other stuff we call dark matter. So cosmologists reviewed all the evidence and voted to convict the universe of dark matter on a majority verdict. So if there is all this non-atomic matter, why can't we see it? Perhaps the right question is, why can we perceive ordinary matter? When I look round the studio, why can I detect lights? Why can I feel these walls? Why does my hand not go right through? After all, my hand is basically empty space. The fraction of the volume of my hand that atoms are actively occupying is minuscule, and about the same thing is true about the wall. So when I put my hand into the wall, you might expect it would pass straight through, but it doesn't. And the answer is electromagnetism. It turns out that there's a lot of stuff with electric charge in my hand and in the wall. So when I push my hand against the wall, the electrons in the outer shells are pushing against each other. And the reason light is emitted or reflected or absorbed by these objects is because these objects have electric charges. Something without an electric charge will be dark, and ordinary matter is bright because it has an electric charge. Let us think about the four forces of the known universe: gravity, strong force, weak force, and electromagnetic force. As we have discussed, gravity is not really a force, but an effect caused by the warping of space-time by mass. The effect of gravity is by far the weakest of these forces. It's basically not measurable in the laboratory. We can barely tell there's any gravity between atoms. It is extremely feeble. We know that dark matter produces gravitational attraction, so dark matter can curve space-time. The strong force glues the protons and neutrons together in the atom. If dark matter interacted through the strong force with the atoms, we would have detected it long ago. The weak force applies to some atomic physics and is seen in radioactive decay. Dark matter certainly cannot interact through the electromagnetic force, that would be way too easy. The thing that terrifies theoretical physicists is if dark matter only interacts with gravity, this will make it very hard to ever detect and analyze. Let's look at what properties the potential dark matter particle would need to have. 1. It obviously must be dark. This means it does not emit any light and doesn't interact with anything to emit light, or any kind of electromagnetic radiation. 2. It must, of course, interact through gravity, so it cannot be a zero-rest particle like photons. 3. It must not interact with itself or interact very weakly with itself. 4. It must be cold, that is, it is not moving at very high speeds, because if it was, then after the Big Bang, it would have just kept on going and not slowed down enough to form halos around ordinary matter. 5. It must be stable, that is, it does not decay, because if it decayed into other particles, it wouldn't still be here now in such large quantities, 13.7 billion years after the Big Bang. In today's universe, everything that we know can be expressed as a combination of 6 quarks, 6 leptons, and 4 particles that carry the forces, and the Higgs boson. Let's contemplate for a second whether any of these known types of energy or matter might make up the dark matter. Well, the first thing that we can do is rule out anything that feels the electromagnetic force. This makes matters much simpler, as it rules out all of our quarks and half of our leptons. Now let's carry one step further and rule out everything that feels the strong force, and again, the quarks are ruled out, but the gluons are now gone, and we're left with a few options, the Z boson and the Higgs boson and the neutrinos. But remember that dark matter that was created after the Big Bang is still around, so it's either stable or extremely long-lived, so we must send home the Z boson and the Higgs boson. And, suddenly, we're left with only 3 particles that are called neutrinos. These look like reasonable candidates. They are extremely long-lived, the most abundant particles in the known universe, but the trouble is they are much too hot, i.e. they are fast. They are travelling nearly the speed of light. That would make them much too light to make up the mass, and very fast particles do not clump together in a way necessary to make galaxies. If we invent a new particle that does not interact with electromagnetism, has no strong force nuclear interactions, but does interact through the weak nuclear force and through gravity, then we have just invented the dark matter particle. Scientists have a name for this particle. It's the WIMP, or weakly interacting massive particle. Why would this particle need to interact through the weak nuclear force? Because it turns out that if we ask the question, what is the rate of interaction of dark matter particle and antiparticle annihilation that would give you the exact ratio of dark matter that we observe today, the answer is that they would need to interact with this strength exactly equal to the strength of the weak nuclear force. This coincidence is called the WIMP miracle. And it so happens that there is a model in particle physics that predicts exactly such a particle. This model is called supersymmetry. Scientists like the WIMP because it was not invented for the purpose of solving the dark matter problem, but comes about naturally in string theory. And string theory requires supersymmetry to work. We will be coming back to string theory in next week's episode. Let us just say today that if supersymmetry is true, then the dark matter mystery could be solved, because there would be a perfect candidate for a dark matter particle in supersymmetry, and it is called the neutralino. But there is a huge problem with the neutralino. We should have found it by now in the Large Hadron Collider, and so far we have not. I was so hopeful, but this raises a big red flag for the theory. There are still unexplored energies and new experiments are being built to look for it. The Axion is the second viable candidate to be the dark matter particle. There are a couple of reasons why axions make attractive dark matter particle candidates. First, they do not require the existence of supersymmetry, and they can be placed in the Standard Model as a much lighter cousin of the Higgs boson. But its very low mass would be made up for in very large numbers. If you had a cubic centimeter of space, it would contain roughly one WIMP particle, if WIMPs were dark matter. But if axions were dark matter, one cubic centimeter of space would contain 10 quadrillion, or roughly 10 to the power of 16 axions. Axion experiments have been done in Hamburg and in CERN, but so far, nothing has been detected. So while scientists have placed big bets that dark matter is likely the WIMP and or the axion, no proof or smoking gun evidence has been found. An early hopeful in the dark matter stakes was the MACHO. MACHO stands for Massive Compact Halo Object, and was one of the first proposed candidates for dark matter. These objects, including neutron stars and brown and white dwarfs, are composed of ordinary matter, so how could they be invisible? The reason is that they emit very little to no light. One way to observe them is by monitoring the brightness of distant stars. As light rays bend when they pass close to massive objects, light from a distant source may be focused by a closer object to produce a sudden brightening of the distant object. This effect, known as gravitational lensing, depends on how much matter, both normal and dark, is in the galaxy. We can use it to calculate the amount of matter lurking around. However, we now know it is unlikely that there are enough of these objects, or that they could produce enough baryons that could accumulate to make up the vast amount of dark matter that exists. This just may be the universe messing with us, or perhaps we need a new theory.
End of Brainy Lecture.
This week's song under the microscope is Grenade by Bruno Mars. And we have another relationship in trouble. Don't go off and listen to it, I will try and capture its essence for you. Bruno kisses his girlfriend, but she kisses him with her eyes open. Bruno sees this as a sign that she is a psycho, who will do bad things to him with strong imagery and weak rhymes. These include tossing him in the trash, rip the brakes out of his car, watch him burn, and beat him till he is numb. On the other hand, Bruno would jump in front of a train, go through pain, leave his hat in Spain, take a bullet in the brain, get splashed by some rain, drown in a drain, nosedive from a crane, get strangled by a chain. Okay, I actually added some of those, but there is clearly a perceived imbalance in the relationship. And all this because she kissed him with her eyes open. The medical condition of not being able to close your eyes is called lagophthalmos. It can be caused by damage to the seventh cranial nerve, which controls the muscles of the eyelid. This could be caused by a blunt injury trauma or a stroke. So we have to review this song in a new light. Is Bruno Mars projecting? Did she suffer at his hand? Catch one too many grenades? Take a bullet in the brain? It is surprising that the things that Bruno Mars says that he would do are all plausible explanations for her lagophthalmos. And here is the final point. How did he know her eyes were open? It doesn't mention that he was testing a webcam and had left it on, and when he reviewed the footage, he noticed that her eyes were open. He knew that her eyes were open because his eyes were open. What is this? A meeting of the Lagophthalmos Society? Do they get together and swap eye drops? All this drama because she was unable to close her eyes, and he does the same. What a psycho. And a second bonus song under the microscope is the mysterious Bob Dylan song Lay Lady Lay. In legal journals, this is given as the first case of evidence being captured by a smartphone. Bob Dylan was famously smitten with all breads enriched with eggs. On arrival in Nashville in January 1969, he checked into the Nashville Arms and asked for a loaf of brioche to be brought up to his room. The message came back that it was not possible as the chicken had not yet laid any eggs. Bob stormed downstairs to the kitchen and grabbed the chicken and stomped with it back to his room. Bob violently shook the bird over his bed while screaming at it to lay. Unbeknownst to him, his bedroom door was not fully closed, and he was filmed on a smartphone, in 1969, abusing this chicken. The police entered the room and demanded an explanation. Bob Dylan said that the bird was his muse and he was writing a song about it. They asked him for the song and he came out with, "Lay, Lady Lay, lay above my big brass bed." He was told that he would not be charged as long as the song was released, and sure enough, Bob Dylan released Nashville Skyline on February the 14th, 1969 with the song Lay Lady Lay. Now we have used genetic techniques to get to the bottom of why the chicken did not lay for Bob. The second verse starts with, "Whatever colours you have in your mind." The colours in its mind refer to the brightly coloured comb on the bird's head. Bob continues, "I'll show them to you and make them shine." Bob grabbed the bird and held it high over the bed so it could see itself in the mirror, and he shook it to encourage the egg to drop. In verse 5 he starts, "Why wait any longer for the world to begin? You can have your cake and eat it too." And this is true for eggs. He can lay his egg, Bob will use it in a cake and share it with the chicken. The cake here is a brioche. Bob is making a reference to Marie Antoinette, oft misquoted, "Let them eat cake." What she actually said was, "Qu'ils mangent de la brioche." Let them eat brioche.
Zut alors!
But back to the brightly coloured comb. Here is the clue. Bob had run down to the kitchen, grabbed a chicken and took it back to his room. The males and females, roosters and hens, are distinguished in most breeds by the males, the cocks, having a larger comb on the head. No wonder it would not lay. Bob Dylan had inadvertently grabbed a cock, not a hen. So Bob Dylan gets filmed shaking his rooster in a hotel room, and the world gets compensated by an enduring poultry-based ballad. Now, I am required to read out the advert. We started this podcast with strong principles, including taking in no advertising money, so we could keep our editorial independence. But we had bills to pay and we started with a new food delivery system in episode 1 called Soup, and then suddenly we were the go-to location for right-wing hate cereals such as Special KKK and the Greg's Fat Diet to remove your wrinkles. This week, though, I'm hoping to avoid all the controversy with our maker of silk and leather luxury goods. Are you embarrassed to go out because of the cold sores on your face? Cover it up with one of our enormous silk scarves from Herpes. Men, want to draw attention away from your zitty face? Get one of our famous spotted Herpes silk ties. Ladies, is your herpes simplex virus making you blue? Cheer yourself up with our Herpes Birkin bags. Wear your painful infection ulcers with pride with a belt, bracelet or earrings with our trademark H logo. Only from Herpes Paris. And now, Hat of the Week. In honour of all our wonderful listeners across Asia, I dedicate this week's Hat of the Week to you. Today we are looking at the Asian conical hat. It is such a perfect design for its function, and it is no surprise that it is worn throughout East, Southeast and Southern Asia. They are used for protection from the sun and the rain, and if made from straw, you can soak them in water and the evaporation will keep your head cool. The weave and the steep handle of the hat keeps the rain flowing down like a thatched roof. They are held in place with a ribbon under the chin and they look absolutely wonderful. Also, historically, they have been worn by farmers and nobility. The Japanese samurai wear them, as do Buddhist monks. They are also popular with young couples, shielding their kisses from the public behind their traditional hats during their dates. Hats will be constructed based on the materials readily available, so palm leaves, bamboo, tree bark. Additionally, for example in Japan, lacquer is applied to the helmets of wood, bamboo and paper to waterproof them. Often the hats have elegant designs, either in the fabric covering or painted on the hat. It astonishes me how something so well designed for the function of rain and sun protection, plus cooling against the heat, can look so beautiful and elegant today, when all the West seems to have done is create the baseball cap. Sadly, the world's most popular hat is the baseball cap, not the Asian conical hat. And I, for one, think that the world is a poorer place for that. And now...
Feeling saucy, you need the shallot. A sauce, my kingdom for a sauce.
This sauce has a few more ingredients than usual, but the thing to remember is with a good fresh piece of fish, it can be cooked incredibly simply with no work. I served this sauce this week with some sea bass that I grilled skin side up. I figure on a sauce taking 10 times the effort of the fish, but the fish will take very little effort. An intense, massively reduced sauce like this will have people discussing it for years to come. It is all about the sauce. Let's go. Sweet and sour pepper sauce. Ingredients: 1 tablespoon of olive oil, 2 shallots peeled and chopped, 1/2 a head of garlic split horizontally, unpeeled, 1/2 a teaspoon of coriander seeds, 2 red peppers and 1 yellow pepper, cored, deseeded and chopped, a few tarragon sprigs roughly chopped, 60 ml white wine vinegar, 250 ml Noilly Prat or other dry vermouth, 200 ml of vegetable or chicken stock, 20 grams of butter diced. To make the sauce, heat the olive oil in a pan and sweat the shallots with the garlic and coriander seeds for 5 minutes until beginning to soften but not brown. Add the chopped peppers and tarragon and stir over a high heat for 3 to 4 minutes. Add the wine vinegar, scraping the bottom of the pan to deglaze. Let bubble until reduced right down and the pan is almost dry. Pour in the vermouth and boil down to reduce by 2/3. Pour in the stock and boil and reduce by another 1/2. Discard the garlic. Tip the contents of the pan into a food processor. Pulse for a few seconds to a rough puree, then strain the sauce through a muslin-lined sieve into a clean pan. Adjust the seasoning, adding up to a teaspoon of caster sugar to balance the acidity, only if required. Set aside and warm when ready to serve. A special note for the uncontacted Aro people of the Amazonian basin, we note that your local supplies of large onions are down this year, but there is an abundant amount of small onions and shallots. Use the smallest, sweetest onions that you can find. Your garlic crop looks good. For tarragon, I am afraid you will need to put an order in at Tesco's.com.
Feeling saucy, you need the shallot. A sauce, my kingdom for a sauce.
And now we have literally the last section. Shakespeare plays that have aged badly. First, we look at the grotesque ramblings that is Measure for Measure. The Duke got tired of ruling Vienna, so he puts a vile operations manager called Angelo in place. All Angelo wants is to have sex with a nun called Isabella. Isabella does not want to have sex with him, or anyone, on account of the whole nun thing. So Angelo says that if she doesn't, he'll kill her brother. What would the correct course of action have been? A. Contact HR and make a formal complaint against Angelo. B. Find the disguised Duke and spend the whole play running around trying to trick Angelo into having sex with his own girlfriend instead. they do B, and they succeed. But then, at the very end of the play, the Duke decides that he is going to have sex with Isabella instead. After he spent the whole play trying to help her stay celibate. And then the play just ends. Oh, did I mention that this rape fest is a comedy? Next up is The Winter's Tale. The Winter's Tale came out shortly after David Attenborough released Life on Earth. In the play, Antigonus has to leave the baby princess in the woods to die, but then a bear appears and eats him. How random is that? In the middle of the play, out of nowhere, a bear pops up and eats him. The play is literally called The Winter's Tale, and it took place in winter. You know, the season signifies by bears hibernating. Oh, I can hear you hammering at your keyboards. Hang on, Ian. This is the play where the statue literally comes to life, but it is the ursine sleeping habits that you object to. Fair point, irate, fictitious literary scholar. The play, however, does give us the best stage direction ever given in theatre. Exit pursued by a bear. Still, David Attenborough would have done better. The violence against women continues with a slasher play that is Titus Andronicus. Demetrius and Chiron violently rape Lavinia, then cut off her hands and tongue to stop her revealing her attackers. Lavinia manages to write their names by holding a stick in her mouth and writing in the dirt. Lavinia's father, Titus, grinds up Demetrius and Chiron and bakes them into a pie and feeds it to the emperor at a feast. Shakespeare was silent on what sauce was served with the pie. And finally, the best rom-com of them all, The Taming of the Shrew. Baptista offers his daughter Catherine to the man who can offer her the most financially. Thus, Petruchio acquires a rich but headstrong woman as his bride. At the wedding, he punches the priest and later refuses to attend the family party. He drags his bewildered wife through the mud to his country house, where he starves her, deprives her of sleep, and contradicts every word she says. By the time they return to the father's home, the woman is meek and submissive. Yep, it is yet another Shakespearean comedy. Shakespeare, you are a psycho. And that is the end of literally the last section. It is also the end of this week's podcast. In next week's Frenzied and Sustained, our brainy lecture looks at string theory. Our song Under the Microscope ponders why we are still singing about Polly putting the cat along and her antimatter particle Suki taking it off again 200 years after they first decided to make tea. And in literally the last section, we will investigate how words come into existence. Please visit
Frenzied and Sustained.
.com for the transcript and to click on the link that says please say hello, just to say hello, suggest a source, a hat, or a song whose meaning eludes you. Please review Frenzied and Sustained on Apple Podcasts.
Frenzied and Sustained, Frenzied and Sustained. Welcome to the podcast. Frenzied and Sustained, Frenzied and Sustained. Let's talk physics and relativity. A sauce. My kingdom for a sauce. Our song under the microscope. Frenzied and Sustained, Frenzied and Sustained, Frenzied and Sustained. Boy.